It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A school in Manitowoc had to close for a day last month, not because of a snowstorm, but an infestation of spiders. School principal told news outlets that a teacher and student sustained bites. Call in about what you want to know about the spiders that take up residence in your home. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Mike Draney is here, professor in the Department of Natural and Applied Sciences at UW Green Bay. Mike, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate. Glad to be here.
What did you make of the spider incident at the Manitowoc Middle School?
It's a little bit surprising. Spider bites are often reported, but they seem to be actually fairly rare events. And two people getting bit by spiders at one time in one place, it would be an unusual occurrence for sure.
Do you have to kind of see the bite happening, or is there something on the skin? Like, why would it be rare?
Yeah, so usually a spider bite is much like a wasp sting. Someone feels a sharp pain, and then you see a spider biting you. But that's not usually how it works when people think they're bitten by spiders. Instead, they see a red mark or a dot or a wound or a sore on their body, and then they attribute it to a spider. And that's not really a very good way to do it, because there's so many other things that are more likely to cause those marks on your body. So many insects that like to bite people, and they have good reason to bite people, unlike spiders. And then also there's lots of different kinds of allergies, infections, burns that can cause, you know, these kind of problems on people's skin.
What about the identification of these spiders as yellow sac spiders? What can you tell us about yellow sac spiders?
Yeah, well, certainly that's a reasonable guess if this was a medium-sized yellow spider. But as far as I know, nobody who knows how to identify spiders was shown a spider from that incident. So I'm not certain whether it really was a yellow sac spider or not. There's about 500 species of spiders that live in Wisconsin, and there's more than a dozen species that would live inside in the winter and are medium-sized yellow or tan or light brown spiders. So it's really hard to say which spider it might actually have been from my perspective.
So, maybe an armchair spider enthusiast might not exactly be able to identify this kind of spider super easily.
Yes, that's right. And if you Google yellow sac spider, you will see a photo that may look like the spider that people saw, but there are so many spiders that look very, very similar. And us arachnologists have to look at the reproductive parts of the spiders under a microscope to be sure of which species it is. And as far as I know, nothing like that was ever done. I certainly was not shown the spider.
Well, you know, extermination called in. What would you recommend that a school do in a situation like this?
Well, I mean, to me, it seems like an overreaction to close the school, given the fact that, even one spider bite is a fairly unusual occurrence. I guess I can understand why they did it. It's about human psychology. It's not about the spiders, but it's not very likely that there's really an infestation of spiders in a building. These spiders that come inside your house in the wintertime, they don't reproduce in your house. And they also tend to eat each other. If there's a bunch of them around, they will eat each other and there'll be fewer of them. So they kind of limit their own populations. And so it's not very often that you get large numbers of these overwintering spiders in people's houses. So, you know, I didn't see anything. I don't know what happened there, but I would think that they could have waited for a convenient time to call in the exterminators and not necessarily close the school down.
Talking about overwintering spiders with Mike Draney, who is an entomologist and professor at UW Green Bay. You can join in on spiders in the winter along the way here, 800-642-1234. Mike, before we go any further, can you walk us through like the best way of or the correct way of relocating a spider, you know, say back outdoors if you don't want it inside your home?
Yeah. So, you know, the spiders are, once you see the spider and you know it's there, you know, spiders don't attack you and they don't really have any reason to bite you except for, you know, defensively. So it is pretty easy to kind of corral a spider into a Tupperware container or something like that, get them to run into the jar, put a jar over them. and then maybe place some cardboard in between the jar and the opening, and you can just walk out and dump it out. If you don't want to do something like that, you can vacuum up spiders. They certainly are susceptible to that, and they're not going to come back out of your vacuum cleaner, I'm pretty sure. So yeah, you can certainly deal with them. You know what I do? I just simply leave them all alone. Every time you see a spider in your house, in order for it to complete its life cycle, you know, in your house, they're going to eat, you know, dozens of insects during the course of their life. And so you're actually going to see fewer creepy crawlies total in your house if you let the spiders go.
Can you explain a little bit more there how spiders are helpful in keeping other pest populations in check?
Yeah, I mean, that's what they do. They're generalist predators. They'll eat just any sort of insect that's in the right size range. And that's pretty much all they eat. So if you have spiders in your house, they're going to be eating a lot of insects. And in general, it's going to result in a lot fewer animals in your house.
What are the other types of Wisconsin spiders that might head indoors for the winter or that we might see around the house in the winter?
Yeah. So first of all, there's sort of two categories of spiders here. There are some spiders that live in our houses and reproduce in our houses. And you've probably seen these very long-legged cellar spiders.
Sure.
Those are not from Wisconsin. And they get moved around by humans and they live in our houses and they love our basements. And so they're going to be around all the time. But there are a good number of spiders that seek sheltered microhabitats in the wintertime so that they can avoid freezing to death during the winter. That's how they overwinter, not as eggs, but as either baby or adult spiders. And some of them have this instinct to find cracks in trees and things like that, and they will find their way into your house. You might say it's kind of on accident. They're not trying to find a warm house to live in, but they're trying to find a sheltered spot to survive. And so those ones are just going to mostly be inactive in your house, although if your house is so warm that oftentimes they do wake up and start walking around, maybe looking for a different spot, looking for water, and that's when you'll encounter them. But they're not out to try to bite you. They're just out trying to look for a place to basically, most of the ones are going to be making a little sleeping bag or tent to sleep in, and oftentimes they make that little tent between the wall and the ceiling of a room. And so that's where you often find these spiders hanging out inside of a little silken sack, which is why they're called sack spiders, up by your ceiling.
Well, let's take a call. John in Richland Center. John, hi. What's the question?
Hi. I have a question and a comment. Some people are afraid of spiders. I'm not. And my question is, how does a spider pump spider blood all the way into those long legs?
Thank you, John. Go ahead, Mike.
That's an interesting question. Yeah, so they do have an open circulatory system. So, you know, inside of their exoskeleton, there's blood, just like the caller said. And it's true that it can be difficult to get that blood all the way to the end of those hollow legs. And the spider does have a heart. It's kind of like an open blood vessel that contracts and pumps blood from the back of the spider's body towards the spider's head. But most spiders also have accessory pulsatile organs in their shoulders of their legs. And these muscles will contract and pump blood into the spider's legs. It's not as critical, though, to get blood everywhere in the spider's body because that blood does not carry oxygen like our blood does. It just carries waste products and food and hormones and things. And so the spider gets a lot of oxygen via another route, and it doesn't have to worry about getting a lot of blood when it's running fast or anything like that.
Oh, that's just fascinating. Arachnid researcher, biology professor, UW Green Bay, Mike Draney is here exploring the lives of spiders in winter months. Call in with your questions of all sorts. Share your spider sightings. What happened? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer. Kent, dozens of spiders temporarily forced the closure of a middle school in Manitowoc last month. The exterminator called in. We called on the arachnid researcher to answer your questions about the life cycle of spiders. Mike Draney's here from UW Green Bay, stays with us. Let's go to Anne in Milwaukee. Anne, hi.
Hi. I'm an elementary school teacher, and we had a specialist come in and talk to my class who were all afraid of spiders. And he was telling them that the spiders can't really bite them because the way their mouth is shaped, kind of like when your apple is too big and you can't get your mouth open enough to bite into it. And so with the closing of that school and all the talk about spider biting, I thought you would be the perfect person to ask, is he right about that? Like, is it difficult for spiders to actually bite the human skin?
Mike, what can you tell us?
Well, I would say that there definitely are spiders that can bite people. And it, in generally, it has to do, I think that the speaker was correct in that very small spiders generally can't bite humans. And so if the spider is, if its body is smaller than about a quarter of an inch, it's really too small to bite people. And so when you see tiny little spiders coming out of an egg sac or something, those are not capable of biting people. But if it's a spider that's larger than about a quarter of an inch, like those sac spiders, or certainly a very large wolf spider or something, they certainly are capable of biting people. Of those, there are some that are very reluctant to bite people. Spiders that live in spiral orb webs generally won't bite people, even if you pick them up with your bare hands. But a sac spider or a wolf spider, if you pick it up with your bare hands, or if it makes its little sleeping bag inside of a glove or a shoe, and then you put your hand in that glove, it may very well bite you. So they bite you, they inject venom. In general, the venom of spiders is not dangerous to people, but it can cause a lot of pain. So it feels like a bee sting or something like that, or wasp sting. There are very few spiders that whose venom is dangerous to humans, and those ones are definitely to be avoided. But for the most part, they don't live in Wisconsin.
Anne, thanks so much. Let's go to Christina in Glenwood City. Christina, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I'm delighted to speak to you. I have a comment and a question. The comment, my sister was going to call an exterminator because she said her son was getting spider bites all over his legs, but it turned out it was a reaction to processed food. So that's the comment. But my question, I've always wondered this. Can spiders run across each other's web, or will they get stuck like insects do?
Okay, well, that's a very interesting comment. And I think that is very common that people think they've been bitten by spiders and then it turns out to be something else. It's oftentimes hard to figure out what that other thing might be. So anyway, I appreciate that story. As far as spiders and their webs, there's a couple things going on. Some spiders don't make webs to catch food. And so those ones can't walk on other spiders' webs any better than an insect can. Those sorts of spiders, many spiders have two claws on each leg, and they basically use them kind of like the hooves of a horse or something to get traction and to run on the ground. But spiders that make webs generally have three claws, and they kind of capture the silk thread in between those three claws. And so that allows them to walk on the web without getting tripped up. The other thing is that web spinning spiders have an oil that they produce on the ends of their legs, and it basically repels the sticky silk that makes up part of the web. And so those spiders don't get stuck in their own sticky silk. So it is possible that a spider could get caught in another spider's web, though, yes.
When you were talking about the vacuum cleaner and sucking up those spider webs, I always wonder if I just leave the spider and I take their web, are they going to make that web very easily, or am I really, kind of ruining their day?
You might be ruining their day, but you're probably not going to kill them.
Okay.
Those orb web spiders, they actually make their web fresh every day.
Huh.
So they'll take it down at the end of the night or at the end of the day, ball it up, and then eat the silk. And that's how they reclaim some of the protein and that the silk, the web is made of. And they also eat little bugs that they can't otherwise eat. But the spiders that live in your house oftentimes make a web and they keep repairing it over time. But taking that web down might ruin their day, but they can make more webbing. And so you're definitely not killing them by removing their webs. And so I say, go ahead and remove all the webs you want.
Good to know. Let's go to Beth in Milton. Beth, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question. I have some fairly large spiders that live in my basement. And every once in a while, I'll come across one that appears to be dead in the middle of the basement floor. And I'll go to grab a Kleenex or a paper towel to pick it up, and it's gone. And so I'm wondering, do spiders play dead?
Do spiders play dead?
Yes, some of them do play dead. It's also true, though, that most spiders spend about 99.9% of their time completely still. Most of them are waiting around for prey to come, and it doesn't happen very often. And so they need to be very still so they're not using up very much energy. They can go without food much, much longer than we can. They can go for weeks or months without eating, but they do that by being still a lot of the time. And so it might be that the spider wasn't really playing dead, but simply doing its normal thing of not moving. And then when you came, you scared it, and then it ran away. But it's really hard to say without having seen the the event.
What about where their bodies go dormant? I think it's diapause. But what is the difference between that happening versus like hibernation?
It's really a continuum. Spiders, they are more active. Their bodies metabolize faster at higher temperatures and slower at lower temperatures. So in the wintertime, especially the spiders outside in Wisconsin's winters, their metabolism is naturally going to be extremely low when it's cold out. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they don't eat during the entire winter. They can't digest food at those low temperatures. So they are going to metabolize very, very slowly indeed. And essentially, that's what diapause is they just, they're mostly inactive. They're alive, but they're not running around. They're not reproducing. They're not even digesting their food. So that's essentially the way that spiders get through the winter, by just having a very low metabolism.
Mike Draney with us, entomologist professor at UW Green Bay. Let's go to Lou in Ashland. Hi, Lou.
Hey, good morning. I just want to thank you for bringing this out. I think spiders are pretty awesome. I did have a fear years ago, but over the years now, I have gained a lot of respect for all the creepy crawlies and our little children of the insect and animal world. And during the winter months, I will relocate a spider if it's going across like an active part of the house, like a counter. Maybe I'm working on something. And I'll relocate them to the furnace room, which is, it just has a furnace and mops and stuff. But a safe place where they can go to, because of course, it's winter, it's snow, it's not going to be good if they go outside. But you know what? They're just trying to get through life just like the rest of us. And we all have to respect each other.
Oh, I love that story, Lou. Thank you so much. Furnace room, spider room. That works, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great story. And it's true that most of the spiders in your house, one of the things they really lack is some water. So if you have a damp basement, that's probably the best place for them. But in the summertime, if you see a spider that you're not familiar with in your house, it's there accidentally, and your house is basically a trap for it. So just catch it and let it outside, and you're probably doing it a favor. In the wintertime, if you throw a spider out in the winter, very likely to freeze to death, because it takes them a few days to cold harden. They have to be exposed to cold but not lethal temperatures, and then they build up antifreeze compounds in their bodies, which prevents them from freezing at 32 degrees Fahrenheit. And if you just throw them out all of a sudden, they don't have that cold hardening, and they will just freeze to death.
That makes me wonder how those extreme fluctuations in temperature affect spiders. When we have a deep freeze and then a thaw and a deep freeze, does that affect spiders?
Yeah, it could for sure. They can become active prematurely. Although I think they're pretty, any spider that lives in Wisconsin has to, be very careful about when they're active. Mm-hmm. You know what I think is the big problem for the spiders with global climate change is that snow is actually spiders' friend for the most part. The underneath the snowpack, there's usually a little melted spot, a hollow space near the ground. And many spiders spend the winter in leaf litter or actually in that subnivian, they call it the subnivian space underneath the snow. Hmm. It's much warmer down there than up where we are above the ground. And when there's no snow on the ground, then it can get very cold on the ground. And that's when the spiders tend to die more often during the winter. So snow is actually the spider's friend for the most part.
Mike, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, it's great. Great talking about spiders with people that are not afraid of them.
Mike Duraney, biology professor, UW Green Bay. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Milwaukee County advances allocating about $1.6 million in federal ARPA funding to a New York charity. It's part of a plan to purchase and erase an estimated $153 million in medical debt held by tens of thousands of county residents in financial need. We look at the future of debt forgiveness and the mission of this work. Call in about medical debt collections. Your questions and stories, they're welcome at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Allison Sesso is president and CEO of RIP Medical Debt, which buys and then eliminates medical debt for people facing financial hardship. Allison, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
So your nonprofit, it partners with communities nationwide to eliminate medical debt for their residents, like you're in Cook County, Illinois, and Toledo, Ohio, New Orleans. Can you take us inside this proposed partnership between RIP Medical Debt and Milwaukee County?
Absolutely. And thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to talk about our work. It's unfortunate that we have to do this work. I'll start with that, because medical debt is clearly a pervasive problem in the United States, to the tune of there being at least $195 billion of debt, medical debt in the United States. So it is really a systemic problem. What we do is we work with communities by combining both dollars that are given by the local government. And traditionally, this is kind of new for us to be working with governments. Traditionally, we've been using donated dollars, and that could be very wealthy people or, you know, people who are giving $10, $20, $50. And I mean, what's wonderful about our model is it really helps anyone be a philanthropist. And we take those dollars, we combine them together, and we purchase debt either from the secondary market or directly from providers, hospitals, other physician groups. And when we get our hands on that debt, we relieve that debt en masse for thousands of people that are in that file that qualify for our program. And that is people who are 400% of poverty level and below, and people whose debt itself is 5% or more of their overall income. And those people are then free and clear of that debt, and that has real great implications for their financial, mental, and physical well-being.
Can you explain how this process is unfolding in Milwaukee County?
Absolutely. So there's actually been some interest across the state in our work. Basically, they reached out to us and sort of, you know, I think they paid attention. You mentioned that they were working in these other places like New Orleans and where it started in Cook County and Toledo. And so the word's been getting out that local governments have been trying to leverage our model for their communities. So they reached out to us and said, you know, can we do this? Is this, you know, got information about our program and how it works? Understood that the return on investment is significant, meaning $1 relieves as much as $100 of medical debt because of the way the for-profit debt market works and the fact that we are mimicking that. So we're able to really leverage local dollars. And in this case, it's ARPA dollars or federal dollars that were given to the local government. And so they're allocating these funds for us to, we get into a contract with the local government. And then what we'll do is we will start talking and we already have started doing this, start talking to the local hospitals and other healthcare providers in the region and get them to engage with us and then sell the debt to us. And we'll put the dollars to, you know, towards that and then start sending out letters to local residents. It's really not that complicated.
How do you negotiate, like, an extremely discounted rate for the debt.
Yeah, so this is a function of the market. So essentially, in the for-profit debt buying world, so the audience understands, there is a for-profit debt buying world. These are hospitals will sell their debt portfolios. And I want to be clear, not all hospitals will sell their debt portfolios, but 25 to 30% will. And so they sell their, basically the debts that people owe them in bulk to for-profit debt buyers. Those for-profit debt buyers, once they have and own those debts of those individuals, can do whatever they want to try to collect on them. You know, they can garnish wages, they can, you know, take them to courts, they can seize assets like your homes or cars. They can just, you know, be really annoying, like and incessantly call them and threaten them. And they take different tactics to try to make back the money that they spent. Because of the fact that a lot of the people who don't pay their debts are people who can't pay their debts. They're people that are poor, or are close to poverty. They're not able to pay those debts. It's very hard for the debt buyer that bought that portfolio to make their money back. And so they have to, in order to make sure that they're going to basically make their money back, they need to make sure that they pay a really low price initially for the debt. And so that really pushes down the price of the debt that the hospital is willing to sell. So let's just theoretically say that the portfolio of debt could be worth face value, what the individuals owe is like $300 million in debt. The debt buyer might buy that entire portfolio for only $1 million because they have to make sure that they're able to harass people, seize assets, do all of those tactics in order to get back at least $1 million plus to make their money back.
So they're making a kind of a bet. There is a risk.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so we are leveraging that market that's established because of that, except we're not trying to make any money back because we are a nonprofit and we're doing this for a mission purpose. And so we just leverage that pricing and then we are able to, you know, basically compete and make a deal with the hospital ourselves and relieve the debt.
Why do you think that local governments should have skin in the game, should be contributing some of these dollars, or why is it necessary to have that local buy-in?
Yeah, you know, I think local governments across the country typically do invest in social interventions, right? I think that there is a recognition that government plays a role. And to be honest, depends on locally the difference. Like in certain places, it's more robust, the social interventions, in other places, less so. But to an extent, every local government is somehow engaged in lifting up those in the community and oftentimes pays for social interventions or supports them. It could be, you know, a workforce development program or you know, it could be a senior center. You know, these are social interventions that help families, helping support childcare services, things like that. So I see this among that sort of suite of services, if you will, that government is engaging in to help people economically and socially within their communities to make sure people are better off and living healthier, more robust lives.
And it's interesting, too, because some governments feel this is out of their lane. Wauwatosa, just down the road, their city council voted against this partnership between your organization, RIP Medical Debt, and you know, Wauwatosa, this Milwaukee suburb. And the Journal Sentinel was reporting that some elders said it was outside the lane of the council to fund nonprofits. What is your take on that?
Like I said, I think that's a local debate. You know, I think this is happening across the country and it's nothing new. Some local governments feel it is their responsibility to take care of the social needs of individuals and have very robust programs that they contract with nonprofits or directly provide services to people in the community. And others are a little bit more hands off and don't have that same philosophy. So honestly, I think this is a philosophical question that each local government sort of grapples with. And again, it's the process. Who are the people that you elect, and what is the philosophy that they support, that you support getting them into office and representing you?
Talking about eliminating medical debt for people in Wisconsin, Allison Sesso is president and CEO of RIP Medical Debt. You can join in 800-642-1234. Allison, a bit more specifics before we move on. How quickly, if everything's approved, how quickly could Milwaukee County residents conceivably see relief? How long does this process take to get to that finish for someone who is, you know, way over their head in medical debt?
Yeah, so I would say it depends. I mean, really, what I have to do is I have to navigate a couple of bureaucracies, which, as you can imagine, can take a little bit of time. What that means is that I have to get both into, like, even if the county puts money forward, I have to then get into officially a contract with them in order to for them to give me the money, right? So that's important. That's just normal course of business. And then I also have to make sure that the hospitals are engaged with us and are in contract with us and able to sell the debt. Though those things can happen quickly, but I also recognize and caution that they can also take time depending on what other priorities and resources are, how resources are being expended at those different institutions. But I would say within 6 months, we should be able to see some initial movement, but it could be a little bit longer.
Let's bring in a caller, Christine in Eau Claire, with a question. Christine, hi.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me on the show. I definitely appreciate what this foundation or nonprofit is trying to accomplish. However, it seems to me that if the hospital or the medical community is willing to discount the medical debt to sell it to a for-profit collector, why don't they just discount it for the initially and then not have to deal with all of this?
Christine,
really obviously
that's a great question. Allison, why is that the case?
Yeah, so it's a really good question. And I think, again, looking at our system overall, it's one we should be asking. I think we should be, you know, sort of asking lots of questions about how we finance healthcare and how the system works overall. The reality is hospitals do have financial assistance policies in place. These are also known as charity care, and they do provide a fair amount of what's called uncompensated care. I also think, and so they do have these policies. Depending on the hospital, how easy it is to get to it, to find it on their website, to know about it, depends. Hospitals have a lot of latitude in who they want to give the discounts to, or who they want to give the free care to, and how they want to actually approach the application process itself. So I'm a big proponent of there being robust, clear and accessible financial assistance policies in place so that there is less for us to do to that point. At the same time, I do think that fundamentally, a lot of hospitals also feel that some of the better actors, I would say, feel that once they stop collecting on a debt, that they are, you know, that there's no harm done to the patient. What they don't understand is that if they've tried to collect on that debt at all at any point, that individual will still feel an obligation to that hospital. So unless they tell affirmatively that individual, we stopped collecting, you know, we wrote it off to bad debt, which they don't do as a normal course of business, that individual will feel that they still owe the debt. They will not go to that hospital, which undermines their, you know, access to care, and they feel a serious mental health strain on them. People feel overwhelmed by the fact that they owe debt. And I think that reality is often lost on the folks at the hospitals. And so we're trying to open up that conversation a little bit more through our work and get them to have a deeper understanding. And to your point, I really think that hospitals can be rethinking and reexamining their financial assistance policies and their communication with patients when they do stop deciding not to collect on debts.
When you're working in these communities around the country, is it difficult to convince hospitals to sell debt to you rather than a for-profit collection agency?
I don't find that particularly difficult. What I find more difficult is getting hospitals that don't normally sell their debt to for-profit debt agencies to sell it to anybody, because they often have policies, to their credit, that they won't sell their debt, right? Because they don't trust, you know, once it's out of their hands, they don't trust what kind of actions are going to be taken against their former patients or current patients. And so hospitals, a fair amount of them, at least 70 to 75%, won't sell their debt at all. So my bigger problem is telling hospitals that don't normally sell their debt to anyone that it's safe and okay to sell it to us, that we will absolutely not collect on it. And we will absolutely let people know that they are free and clear of the debt.
CEO of RIP Medical Debt, Allison Sesso, leading this nonprofit that has acquired and eliminated more than $8 billion in medical debt over nearly a decade, now seeking to partner with Milwaukee County. Call in with your questions about medical debt collections, debt forgiveness, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A plan is moving ahead that could erase medical debt for up to 67,000 Milwaukee County residents in financial need who are mired in this form of debt. The county's ARPA task force approved the funding request a week ago. And we have Allison Sesso, who leads the national nonprofit RIP Medical Debt, which buys medical debt at a discounted rate and then eliminates that debt for people in need. Let's take another call, Nancy in Milwaukee. Nancy, what's on your mind?
Good morning to you. My feeling about this is that none of this need to occur in the first place if our politicians made good decisions about offering health insurance to every single person in America. This indebtedness occurred, I'm sure, because people were too sick. They were very sick, but they didn't have the money to go to a doctor, and so they stayed home until their symptoms worsened to the point where they had to go to the hospital. All that could have been avoided had they had health insurance to begin with. And the fact that if they have symptoms, they'll go to an emergency room, which always costs more than a simple doctor visit. So if our politicians made better decisions about the involvement of every single person having health insurance,
I want to stop you there because I want to, you know, field that to Allison. Are people who are mired in this type of debt, would health insurance be the difference?
You know, I wish that was the answer. That's what Obamacare tried to accomplish and actually did accomplish. 92% of the population actually has health insurance in 2022. The problem is that the health insurance does not meet their actual financial needs. And so what I mean by that is that they are underinsured, and that's the new problem of medical debt. People have insurance, but they don't have enough insurance. They have very high deductibles that don't meet the amount of money they can pay. So if you're living paycheck to paycheck and you have a $1,000 deductible, well, guess what? You're not going to be able to pay that $1,000 deductible. And so that's the medical debt that you're going to be in, $1,000. Sometimes those medical debts are, those deductibles are even higher. Certain individuals, how you lower your premium, how much you pay for health insurance out of pocket, depends on how much you agree to pay in terms of a deductible. So the less you pay every month to have health insurance, the higher your deductible. So you end up needing care, you can't pay that amount that you're on the hook for. And that is the risk that we're expecting more and more Americans to deal with. And that's what's undermining people's ability to make ends meet. So this is really an issue of underinsurance. There was actually a new statistic out this last year by Kaiser Health, who does a lot of research around these issues of health and medical debt. And they said that the number one cause today of medical or predictor of medical debt, of whether or not you're in medical debt, is whether or not you get sick, not whether or not you have insurance. So that is the scary reality that we are facing today.
How about this nuance? Sarah in Libertyville, Illinois, called in to ask if people whose debt is being written off, are they people who don't own assets or have low income, so the system is unlikely to collect what is owed otherwise?
A lot of these people aren't going to get, most of this money is not, people are never going to pay this. I mean, that is the reality. So most of the individuals will never pay the debts that they owe. And so this hospitals actually understand that. And what they ultimately end up doing, they have what's called they refer to them as a payer mix. So a payer mix means people who have good insurance that have money that are part of their hospital and people who don't. And what ends up happening is cost shifting, essentially. So the people who do have good insurance end up having to pay, their insurance companies, but they pay more. But that puts pressure on those who have good insurance And those insurance rates are likely to go up over time. So this is really a snowballing problem because of the cost shifts and the fact that more and more the expectation of what people pay out of pocket doesn't match their financial reality.
Allison Sesso, President and CEO of RIP Medical Debt, as we look at the state of debt forgiveness here in Wisconsin. Allison, you know, there is talk about your organization, you know, working with entire states on medical debt on a statewide level. Wisconsin here, we have a budget, a big budget surplus. A neighboring state like Minnesota does as well. So what does that mean if a state would decide to scale up in a big way and do it on a statewide level? What would you see in terms of the outcomes?
I mean, I think it would be pretty incredible to get rid of all of the medical debt across, you know, that we can get our hands on. It will require cooperation, though. The important part of this is government can want to do this all they want. But at the end of the day, we absolutely need the providers to come to the table and agree to sell the medical debt. And that's an important element of this. So provided that we can get the hospitals engaged, get the other healthcare providers engaged, we could do massive debt relief. However, I do want to caution that that is not that's going to be really helpful to people today. But long term, we do need bigger solutions. And my hope and my expectation is that if we're doing this work and we're paying attention, we actually have an anthropologist on our team whose job it is to talk to those whose debt we relieve, to help lift up their stories, to tell the story of medical debt and what it means for individuals, so that we can put bigger pressure on those politicians to make bigger changes that actually address some of this fundamentally and more holistically. I think, for example, the earlier caller talked about insurance. I do think that while a lot of people are insured, we can provide greater subsidies to individuals so that they have better insurance and go into the hospital with more coverage and don't have those high deductibles. So there's lots we could do to prevent people from having extraordinary collections actions. Those are things like garnishing your wages, taking your assets. We can make those things illegal. So there are steps that I think politicians can take. And I'd love to do this work in mass and clean up the mess of past policy. But I would really like to make sure that at the same time, we're looking forward and trying to make sure that I don't have to keep doing this work in perpetuity.
Allison, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Allison Sesso is president and CEO of RIP Medical Debt. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.